Unfortunately, tonight it is just myself and my daughter who are here. Hillary is sick, not feeling well. And so if you could be praying for her. And Mark stayed home with her to get him to bed a little early. Right before the meeting started, I was over here speaking with Tanya, and she reminded me one of the reasons why it's particularly difficult for me to speak here in Reidsville. She said that often Ray preaches here, and he uses me in illustrations. And I just thought, well, how can I overcome that? And I thought it would be a great time to share some stories about Ray. But I've only got about 2 hours, so I just figured it's not even worth the time, not even worth the effort. But tonight I do hope to share about what God is doing through us in Senegal. Real quick, if you don't know where Senegal is, look at a map of Africa, and as far west as you can go in Africa, that's where we are. We are in a city called Thiès, which is the second biggest city in Senegal. I've heard anywhere between 200,000 and 1 million people. I have absolutely no idea which side of that's true. It's a big city with no stoplights, which is very interesting. Thiès. So I hope to share some about our work, and I hope to also encourage you with what the church is doing in other parts of the world. A lot of times we hear statistics about how the church is in decline in the West, or the church is in decline in America, and we can get in our Eeyore moments and think, oh, how poor we are and how gloomy the situation is. Yes, it is true the church is struggling in certain parts, but in many parts of the world, the church is booming and the church is really growing. And while there is certainly a lot of work to be done in Senegal, it's still 94% Muslim. Even though it is that Muslim, the church is growing and there are a lot of exciting things that are happening there. I wanted to quickly read, though, in Hebrews chapter 11, a few verses before I get started and share some of what God is doing in Senegal. Share a few verses that can put into perspective a little bit what our last year and a half has been like. We left the U.S. January 1st, 2009. We left to go to France to study French. The official language in Senegal is French. I teach at a Bible college. I teach in French. The church we go to, the worship service, everything is in French. So we went to France first to learn French, came back to the U.S. for 6 weeks before going to Senegal, and we've been in Senegal for a little over a year and a half before we came back, and things did not completely go as we had planned. I'd like to read a few verses from Hebrews to put into perspective some of what I'm going to share tonight. I'll begin reading in verse 8, Hebrews chapter 11, verse 8. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to a place that he was to receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he went to live in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. By faith, Sarah herself received power to conceive, even when she was past the age, since she considered him faithful who had promised. Therefore, from one man, and him as good as dead, were born descendants, as many as the stars of heaven, and as many as the innumerable grains of sand by the seashore. These all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on earth. For people who speak thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. One of the key points of this chapter is God bringing out the idea of, bringing out how so many godly men and women lived by faith. And that is, things were promised to them, and yet they had to wait a long time. Can you imagine Abraham? He receives this incredible promise. I'm going to make a great nation out of you. through you, all the families in the entire earth are going to be blessed. You're going to have descendants so numerous, you're not going to be able to count them. And yet Abraham never saw that promise fully realized. His kids, Isaac, never saw that fully realized. His grandkids never saw it fully realized. His great-grandkids. Can you imagine how Abraham must have been thinking after he got that promise, thinking, okay, what are we thinking, God? Here, 5 to 10 years maybe? And then 5 to 10 years go by, and he's still waiting and still waiting and still waiting and still waiting. And people of his descendants had to keep thinking, you know, Abraham got this incredible promise. Our grandfather got this incredible promise. Surely it's got to be soon. And there had to be this idea of, when's it going to happen? When's it going to happen? And everyone had to remind themselves that God's timing is not the same as our timing. And we need to be patient and realize that everything's happening according to God's timing. And even if it doesn't progress as quickly as we would like it, that's okay. That doesn't mean things are going wrong. That doesn't mean something bad has happened. And that has been something we have needed to constantly remind ourselves in the last year and a half. We went to Senegal with some pretty big ideas. When we looked at the things, the goals of the things that we wanted to accomplish, we come back and we didn't accomplish everything we set out to accomplish. And in fact, when we got there, there was a professor at Dallas Seminary who used to always say, if you set your goals low enough, you can achieve them. And we quoted that all the time. Because one thing he was wanting to do is calm down guys in seminary that were saying, you know, every time I get out, I'm never going to preach a sermon where I don't spend 40 hours working on that sermon. And he's, well, you might want to set your goal a little bit lower. There might be a few things happen during the week or before you preach that sermon that you might not be able to do everything to the degree that you want to do it. And I think we've realized that in Senegal. And so a good part of what I'm going to share deals with our adjustment just to life in Senegal. And that was a big part of what we did in the last year and a half, was just learn how to live in West Africa. That was a much bigger adjustment and a much bigger task in itself than we had imagined. And so in order to do that, I want to begin by sharing a little bit about our kids and how they adjusted. There is Addie and Mark in their Senegalese outfits. Addie loves it in Senegal because people always dress up, and she gets to wear skirts and dresses year-round. So it's a wonderful thing. Mark is our little Senegalese kid who was all his birth certificates and documents are Senegalese. We had to apply for his U.S. passport and birth certificate. I'll start by sharing about Addie, who did the best as far as adjusting to Senegal. And for her, we were incredibly envious of how well she adjusted to life in Senegal. Here are a few pictures of one of her best friends, whose name is Mami Yassine. She is Senegalese, and she goes to Addie's school. Addie goes to a French school there in TS, which all the teachers, a lot of the teachers' aides and assistants are Senegalese, but the teachers are hired by the French government. It is, we have to pay as if it were a private school, but technically it's a public school. It runs with the French curriculum. So those are, and on the bottom there is another picture of Addie with Mami Yassine. There's Mark, and then her other friend Caleb is another friend from school. And for Addie, I think I was often reminded of the verse that says, you know, we should be content. We brought nothing into the world. We can take nothing out of it. And we quickly realize in our lives that we accumulate a whole bunch of stuff that we think is necessary to be content. But then when that stuff gets taken away, we're really mad, we're really upset. We saw in Addie, because she hadn't gotten used to growing up in America, and we moved there at a pretty young age, she adapted incredibly quickly. One of the tough things to adjust to in Senegal is power cuts. And there were numerous months where you would have a power cut of 8 to 10 hours. You would have power for about 6 or 7 hours. Then the power would go off again for another 8 hours. And we were incredibly frustrated with that. Eventually, we got a backup battery system that let us have lights and fans and run a computer. But initially, that was very difficult. The first month, we had nothing. There were nights when Hillary and myself felt like we were about to burst into tears. And we would be in the dark with a flashlight and just sweat dripping down, thinking, what are we doing? This is crazy. Why are we here? And Addie would have us in tears, different kinds of tears, about 5 minutes later, because she thought it was so fun that we could make shadow puppets in the wall with our flashlights. And for her, that was the greatest thing that we could do that. So she adjusted incredibly well to life there. We also, here's some pictures of Addie at her school where she was in a end of the year play there on the top right there. There's her class on the bottom. Most of the kids are from European background. A lot of the couples have one spouse is European and the other is Senegalese. So there you have Addie's adjustment to Senegal, which went almost without a hiccup. I wish I had been able to easily adapt as easily as she did. The other addition to our transition to Senegal was Mark, who, I guess for him, he's just now learning out what life is like in America. He had never been in anywhere other than, or he grew up in Senegal. That was the norm for him. You'll notice there the hospital, that is where Mark was born, and it was a BYOTP kind of hospital. So we brought our own toilet paper. We brought I had to go wake up the guard or ask the guard where I can get water because there's our bathroom on the right there. On the left there is my bed, so that was the cot that I got put up. And we paid extra for the private room, so we had the luxury suite. But that was quite the experience with Mark's birth. But we were reminded that where we truly have our security and safety from is from God. It's not from a health system or anything else, but it's God. We did have great doctors, but the hospital was definitely not state of the art. The generator was broken whenever we got there. And as soon as the power came back on, the doctor said, hurry, quick, let's call everybody in the OR because we should have power for the next few hours. So it was an interesting experience, but through the whole thing, God watched over us, and Mark was born a healthy baby, and Hillary was home after a C-section after 2 days in the hospital. So God was very gracious to us, and I'm still amazed that my wife was able to endure giving birth in Senegal, but I think she might even say this too. What was even tougher was the pregnancy, as our house was usually in the 90s with humidity in the 90s. Also, and we didn't have air conditioning, so she had it really tough, and I'm still very thankful that God gave me a great wife who was able to put up with all that. Here's on the top left, it was the anesthesiologist, the top right was one of the surgeons, and then the midwife there on the bottom there holding Mark. And for Mark, as I hinted at, his birth was probably changed our goals more than anything that we had imagined. Whenever Mark was born, we really had to put the square wheels on, and our lives slowed down quite a bit. We were hoping to make a lot of progress in learning the Senegalese language of Wolof. That slowed down a lot when Mark was born. When Mark was born, a lot of the time I was preparing for classes. I wasn't able to spend near as much time. And so if we looked at it from man's eyes, it felt like in a lot of ways that we were very frustrated and couldn't get done the things that God wanted us to get done because with the addition of a newborn, our life just became that much more difficult or involved. That would be one way to look at it. As we looked in hindsight, it was interesting to see some of the things that happened as a result of Mark's birth in TS that we had not thought about or not planned or we could have in no way orchestrated other than the way that God had things developed. We have so many neighbors that when we told them that our son was born in that city, they just thought that was awesome. They thought it was so great that we had a Senegalese son and that Hillary didn't leave the country. They said, you know what, that's what all the white people do. They leave the country to go have their baby somewhere else. And we think that's so cool that you stayed and that you chose to have your baby here. And in a lot of ways, that brought us closer to some people than anything else we could have done had we been speaking Wolof fluently at that moment. I don't think they would have been as impressed with that as much as they were that Hillary stayed in Chiesse and had Mark there. And that was something really neat to see. And by the way, as I say that, if there were to be a missionary who moved to Chiesse, Senegal, and chose to have their baby in another country, I would not at all judge them. Not for one second. But God did lead us in that path, and I do think that God has been and is doing some really neat things as a result of Hillary being able to stick that out and go through that. We'll get on to our adjustment to life in Senegal. There's a picture. If you look on the bottom there, you can see Mark. He's easy to miss. But the guy there, his name is Mamadou Diop. He was our Wolof teacher. And one of the big goals that we had in moving to Senegal was to speak Wolof. As I mentioned earlier, French is the national language. But as soon as we landed in Senegal, we got off the airport and nobody was speaking French. And we were a little shocked and somewhat disappointed. Why is nobody speaking French? Everyone in Senegal would prefer to speak a different language other than French. So it is the language, official documents are in French, school is in French. But at home, where the kids are, most kids hear Wolof growing up. And so it's really important to speak that language. People, their eyes light up. And we often get the reaction, that is incredible. Most white people don't bother to learn our language. We really appreciate that you are making the effort to learn our language. That means so much to Senegalese people. And again, we could do our ministry without learning Wolof. I could teach at the Bible College for 30 years and not speak a word of Wolof. But in order to, we hope to also be witnesses to our neighbors, be good witnesses to those around us. And in order to do that, we tried to learn Wolof. As I mentioned, we didn't make near as much progress as we had liked, but we did make some progress and have a basic amount. If I go into a shop, I can talk to people for about 3 minutes and everyone's really impressed with my Wolof. And if I get out of the shop right away, then everything's good. But if I go for that fourth minute, then everyone realizes that I've gone past my limit. So one prayer when we go back is to pick up Wolof. But that was one thing we worked on while we were there. Another part is just adjusting to life in general. You see Mark there adapting to the heat. Before we went to Senegal, I thought I enjoyed the heat. We lived in Dallas and the heat never bothered me. But I realized that I enjoy the heat when I live in a house that has air conditioning. That was quite a bit more adjustment. We were more fatigued and tired than we had realized. Top right, you'll see there, that's a horse cart with a body of a car on the back of it. Driving over there is awful. It's the only way I can put it. I've driven in Dallas and Paris, and I've never really been stressed driving before, but going anywhere in Senegal is very difficult. On the bottom there, as part of our adjustment to learning how to do laundry in Senegal, after about 6 months, right when after Mark was born, and we realized we were needing to wash diapers every couple of days, we finally bought a second reservoir so that we always had water. But water cuts are something very normal. We have some friends, they didn't get water for about 3 weeks. And so they had to go out somewhere and buy water from different people. And a lot of people live with that. That's the norm for their lives. Here's Hillary carrying Mark on her back the way a Senegalese person does. And again, if we go out in public and Hillary carries Mark like that, random people stop us and tell us how cool they think it is that she's carrying her baby the way a Senegalese person does. Here's a slide. On the top left is her name is Anna. She is someone who, she works for us. She helps us around the house, helps us with cleaning. Hillary has been able to develop a good relationship with her, try to help her out some. She is from a Catholic background. And in some ways, I think Hillary and her playing with our kids is one of the few things, few bits of calm or normalcy in her life. She lives with her in-laws, as most women do when they get married, and has an extremely difficult situation, as none of her in-laws like her. But Hillary has been able to develop a relationship with her, been able to minister to her some. On the right there, you'll see when Mom and Dad came over, we were able to go have a meal. We just had tea with this family. And that part of our informal ministry is just helping people in general. And for us, these two people, that they are very good, or these two families are very good reminders to us of what you might see initially if you were to go to Senegal does not tell the whole story. If a white person goes to Senegal, you will most inevitably find random people to just stop you on the road and say, "Hey, white guy, can I have some money?" And you might think that, well, that's what everyone does. That is not at all what everyone does. And these two families are incredible examples of people that almost never ask for money. And we look in their lives and we see incredible needs. But they work really hard, and there have been times where we have been able to minister in their lives and to help them out. The family down over here on the right, they are a Muslim family, but they're very receptive and open to talking about things of the gospel. On the bottom here is some of the street kids that you can't go anywhere without seeing kids begging for money. And I'll come back to that a little bit later. But this is one of the things that we had a very difficult time adjusting to, was the need that is out there. There's an incredible amount of physical need. And for us, we rarely felt confident in the best way to meet that need. We were, I don't know what else to say than we often struggled with what to do. Do we help with this person? How do we know? I have no idea. In America, I can generally have an idea of someone scamming me. That doesn't mean I always know, but I've got a general feel. I know I have a general idea. In Senegal, I almost never have any idea. I'm completely clueless. And that was one thing that we've enjoyed being able to help certain people, but we've also found it very difficult. And that has actually was a huge frustration. But it turned into one of the biggest encouraging things for us, because one, we prayed more than we ever have in our lives. It forced us to rely on God. In addition to that, it reminded us of what our initial calling was. Our initial calling, whenever God called us to Senegal, what we wanted to do was to go there and to equip the Senegalese church to reach the Senegalese. Equip the Senegalese church to be able to spread the gospel and to share the gospel with all the Muslims in Senegal. And while we were there, we realized, okay, we have no idea what we're doing. But if I can teach and can train other people, the Senegalese church does a great job. They do a really good job of responding to a lot of physical needs, while at the same time preaching the gospel, and they have a good way to do that. And they can do it in ways that we can't. As I shared with someone once, if someone has a $50 medical need in Senegal, I could give $20, and they might wonder, well, that's all you're going to give? Why can't you give more? Whereas a Senegalese person from one of our churches could give $5, and they could be incredibly grateful. And it just reminded us of how important it is to do what we're doing, and that is to equip the church to be able to meet these needs. They know far better than we do on how to respond and to meet those needs. And here's a picture. I was able to have a few meetings once with a network of about 30 different churches in NTS and some of the surrounding area. And what's really neat is, actually it's closer to 40 churches, is that if you go back about 15 years ago, there was maybe only around 10. The church is really growing and doing a lot of neat things. And it was encouraging to see a lot of these guys, particularly in this room, that have a strong heart, and they work really hard. They're just really dedicated to seeing God's word going out in Senegal. And that was something that was encouraging to see. And as we start transitioning now, I would like to share also some of the some prayer requests about Senegal in general. I mentioned one Sunday, I think two Sundays ago, that it is a tense time in Senegal right now. There's the political elections coming up, presidential elections, there's currently an 85-year-old president who is in his second term, and during his first term, the Constitution changed, saying that there's a limit. You can only serve two terms. Now he's saying that first term doesn't count. There's a lot of controversy. We would really ask that you be in prayer. Last June, there were a lot of riots, and there was even one person, a member of the government, they burned his house down. So manifestations or demonstrations here in America are extremely tame to what went on over there. So we do ask you to be in prayer for this situation. There's some other dates as far as when the elections happen. And that first round of elections in February, if someone gets 50% of the vote, then that's it. He's president. But if no candidate gets 50% of the vote, there's a second round. And in that first round, there will be over 10 candidates that are running. So it runs much different than the American system. But be in prayer for that. In one sense, Senegal has never had any violence in 60 years. There's always been peaceful transitions. But it's a very unique situation right now, and we have no idea. And there's a verse there, 1 Timothy 2, reminding to be in prayer for those things. And actually, I just remember one thing I wanted to share in talking about our vision of equipping the Senegalese church. One thing I was able to do at some point, I was able to go to a conference that had between 50 to 100 church leaders in Senegal. Most of the church leaders were either Senegalese or African. The topic of the three-day conference was, how are we going to take the gospel to the unreached parts of Senegal? And it was so encouraging. That was not the topic that an American missionary came in and said, okay, we want you guys to talk about this. We're going to pay and sponsor this conference, and this is what we want you to do. There was none of that. Of their own initiative, the Senegalese church is coming up with this and saying, we need to do this. This is something we need to do. We can be helped if other missionaries can come alongside and equip us with that. But even if we don't have that, this is something we need to do. We need to take responsibility. We're not sitting around and waiting for someone else to do it for us. That was incredibly encouraging to see. Here I'll transition to some of the ministries that we were involved in. One ministry that we had not planned on doing at all, but God just dropped in our laps, was at Addie's school. As I mentioned, a lot of the kids are from a European background. One of the lady here on the right, her name is Daniela. Luis and Daniela moved to Senegal to work with street kids. Daniela, there's only two other missionary families at the school. Luis and Daniela is one. Some of the other moms at the school asked Daniela, would you teach the Bible to our kids? I have no idea why some of these mothers asked that, because most of the dads are very much against religion and very much teach that to their kids. Their religion is harmful, it's not good. And we even explained early on who we were. We're not Catholic, we're evangelical. One of the moms was concerned that we might start preaching on miracles or against evolution. And we even sent a letter saying who we are. This is who we are. We are evangelical. We're not set out to say everything or teach against you, but we are going to teach what we believe. And the mom said, okay, that's great. And it was incredible that for 8 weeks, Hillary and Daniela taught a group of kids, many of them had no idea how to pray, taught Bible stories, went through the Gospels, and had some very clear presentations of the Gospel. And so that was something incredible to see. Ask for your continued prayers for that. And it was really neat to see how a lot of these kids singing with enthusiasm church songs. At the same time, be in prayer, because as you can imagine, with all those kids not used to any sort of Sunday school lesson, it was often quite chaotic. But there's a few other pictures with some of the other kids from Addie's school. Another ministry that we had hoped to be involved in, when we went to Senegal, we had no idea what it would look like, was a ministry to street kids. In Senegal, there's a system set up to where a lot of families will send their kids to a Muslim teacher. And I'm not. Some of the parents are from even other countries, or they're very much out in the bush. And so a Muslim teacher might show up and say, "Hey, I'm offering your kid a religious education." Some of the kids, or some parents, feel like they're doing this great thing for their kids, so they send them to these Muslim teachers. What the Muslim teachers will do, if they give any education at all, it's around 5:30 in the morning, where they force these boys to recite the Quran in Arabic, which none of them speak or understand any Arabic. They recite what they don't understand. They're beaten if they fall asleep. And then during the day, these boys are forced to go out and beg for money, which they give back to their Muslim teachers. It's a horrible life for these boys. Some, even as young as 3 or 4, are put into this system. And I forget the age, maybe around 12 or 13, they eventually kick the boys out. And who knows what happens to them. Luis and Daniela was who Hillary worked with the kids club. They moved to Senegal to do something to minister to these boys. And they found out that a lot of boys who are in this system will actually run away from their Muslim teachers so that they can make a step up in living and live on the street. And that still amazes us that there are boys around the age of 6, 7, 8, 9 years old who would prefer to live on the street and would find that easier. Luis has spent several nights going out and figuring out, okay, who are the kids that are going back to their Muslim teachers, because we can't take those kids. But if a kid is genuinely living on the street, they can invite them into a home. And so they have a home that they've rented, and they have these boys coming in, and they spend all days now teaching them literacy, teaching them to read, teaching them French, and they teach them Bible stories. And they're doing that every day, and it's really encouraging to see that. And one, just to share one verse there, Ezekiel 16:49-50. Some of the motivation that we had for being involved in a ministry like this. But behold, this was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had pride, excess of food, and prosperous ease, but did not aid the poor and needy. They were haughty and did an abomination before me, so I removed them when I saw it. When we often think of Sodom and Gomorrah, we think of why God decided to blot them out. We often think of the perversity, the perverse actions, and we think that's why God did it. That's what can draw God's wrath, is if a country is immoral in that sense. Well, this verse says here, one of the reasons why God chose to blot that nation or blot out Sodom was they were prosperous, but they weren't helping anybody. And the church has a big responsibility, I feel, to respond to some of these needs that these boys, these situations where these boys are in. And so that is a ministry we're slowly getting involved in. At the moment, these boys only speak Wolof. And as I mentioned earlier, our Wolof is very basic. So basically what I did towards the end was I went over and played games with them, and I tried to speak Wolof, which that was entertaining in itself to them. They got a lot of jokes out of that. But in the future, we hope to be involved more. And a lot of it just giving a little relief to Luis and Daniela. That is their primary ministry. For us, we have a different primary ministry, but we do hope to be a part of this and to see these boys grow up and to learn God's Word. I tend to think this is a very neglected mission field in Senegal. There's about 100,000 boys like this in Senegal, in a country of 12 million, and the society has kind of left them out. They have left them alone, and I would love to see not just Luis and Daniela, but even the Senegalese church having a heart for these boys and to realize that we can show love to them. We can share the gospel. This is a segment. Most of the Senegalese people are resistant to the gospel. These boys they're open. They're willing to listen. I love that picture on the right with the boy. The boys they have a lot of fun. And the last ministry that we were involved in, which was what we had hoped or to be our primary ministry, was teaching at the Bible College. I was able to teach two classes. Here's some of my students there. One student is he is from a different country, from Gabon, and he will be going back there in a year. And but the other guys are from Senegal. That was just a huge encouragement for me to be able to teach these guys. I taught New Testament theology and church history. And I remember so many times where we were very frustrated with living in Senegal, thinking, what are we doing here? Are we going to make it? Why are we here? This is so difficult. This is so frustrating. I would go to class and I would have a discussion. I would teach something. And I would leave and go back home and tell Hillary, this is what we talked about in class. And she would say, that's why we're here. That's why we're putting up with so many things. These guys are in the Senegalese church, and they have a heart and a passion. And some of the big encouragements for me, so many times as a teacher, you want to teach an application. You want to say, okay, this is God's word. This is how we apply it in our context. And for me, so many times I would go to class thinking, I have no idea how to apply God's word in this context. I mean, in some ways, for sure. Okay, don't lie, don't steal. There's some very broad things. But as far as how do we preach the gospel in Senegal? Or how do we respond to poverty in Senegal? There's so many questions like this that I don't have a good grasp on how God's word applies in that situation. But many times I would show up in class, I would teach what the gospel said or teach what Paul's epistle said, and then I would just throw the question out there, how does this apply? You tell me. And they just like that could rattle off the way that, oh, okay, yeah, now if I'm understanding that correctly, this is how it applies. One day when we were in church history class, we were talking about the church, the early church, and Justin Martyr, who in the second century, he took it upon himself to clarify who the church was. The early church, we know, was not afraid to endure persecution. They endured persecution, and if that came as a result of preaching the gospel, they were ready to do that. But a lot of times, the church was persecuted, not because the church preached the gospel of Christ, but simply because nobody knew who they were, and they were afraid of something that was unknown. And they just persecuted something more because the Christians were unknown. And so you can read documents about the church being persecuted because they thought that Christians were cannibals, because of the way people talked about the Lord's Supper, about taking the body and the blood and the body of Jesus Christ. So people thought, oh, well, they're cannibals. There were all these misconceptions. Justin Martyr wrote saying, these are the perceptions you have of us. This is who we are. I posed the question to my students one day, all right, in Senegal, when we think of the Senegalese people, how do they view the church? And then what are the things about the church that they misunderstand that we need to do a better job of presenting clearly? And right off the bat, they named them. They knew that, you know what, people do not understand the difference between Catholics and evangelicals. And so many Catholics are alcoholics in Senegal. We need to find ways to explain and to teach to the culture at large that there's a difference. There's a difference between us. Nobody understands in Senegal the difference between Catholics, evangelicals, Jehovah's Witnesses, or Mormons. There's a need for that. People explain, a lot of people think that Senegal or that Christianity is a Western religion. Ironically enough, a lot of people in Senegal, this one surprised me, think that Christianity is a Central African religion. Because people that have come to Senegal who are Christian are either white, coming from America or Europe, or they're from Central Africa, where the church has grown dramatically. And we had discussions about, okay, what can we do to correct that misperception? What are ways that we can make sure people truly hear what the gospel is? Because we know for sure when someone is making these statements about the church, they have no idea what the gospel is. They've completely misunderstood who we truly are. And something that we have a heart to do is to work with some of the church leaders and to help them think through what are the ways that we can do a better job of, in our churches, clearly presenting to society at large who we are. And that is a lot of our heart, a lot of what encourages us, what burdens us. And I'll close with this last example of what we would like to see develop in Senegal. And that is, if you think about the church in America, we are spoiled especially in one sense. Whenever there's a big controversy that comes out in America, there are some very, very gifted teachers and scholars who are able to respond to those needs. You think of the last few years of Richard Dawkins, or I'm drawing a blank on his name, but the guy who just recently passed away. Hitchens. Christopher Hitchens. A lot of these guys they're really attacking Christianity. We have some very gifted individuals in the church who have written books to help people in the church to respond to this. I think of Ravi Zacharias. I know when the Da Vinci Code came out, Daryl Bach at Dallas Seminary, in 1 week he wrote a book against the Da Vinci Code. There are so many people like that that are equipped and provide an incredible service that I think a lot of us take for granted. In Senegal, there is nothing like that. If there's a controversy, something that threatens the integrity of the church, we would love to help the leadership in Senegal develop to where they could think clearly and do a good job of providing resources or providing ways that the average person in the church can know how to respond, can have a way to respond and accurately present the gospel in Senegal. And that is, again, that is what our heart is. And to go back to Hebrews 11, we have no idea, I think that's the last one, we have no idea God's timing on this. This could be a situation where we, like missionaries in Senegal in the 60s or 70s, worked for years seeing a handful of converts, seeing a handful of people turn to Christ. Or it could be situations where in the last couple of years there have been instances where people have preached the gospel and had 50 or 100 or 200 people respond and turn to Christ. We have no idea how things will progress according to God's timing, but we are very encouraged with what God is doing in Senegal and hope that you also will continue praying for what God is doing in Senegal.